Thank you both very much. I'll take the prerogative and ask the first question, mostly because I can. You both raised so many issues, and I'm going to try and just choose one question for each of you. On the issue of Afghanistan, Pakistan, the Fatah area, ungoverned, and focusing on the German plot, which highlights both the issues raised in the recent National Intelligence Estimate and the homegrown radicalization issues raised in the recent New York Police Department report, one of the things I'm left wondering about is how important in all of this, is it important in all of this? Is this one thing you mentioned in passing, finding bin Laden? Would it have a tactical impact at all? And even if it wouldn't, in terms of the radicalization on the internet sites that you discussed, would that have denying them this figure and this leader have an impact? And Chris, I'm going to draw out on one thing you said and one thing you didn't, but that Mike hung you out to dry on, saying that you might touch on. Thank you, Mike. The first is, if I could get you to talk a little bit more in terms of what you would recommend be done that isn't being done towards a peace process, given that there is an effort to have an international conference, and given that we can want peace for our own reasons, altruistic and otherwise, as much as we like, but there have to be partners on the ground who are able to do it and who are willing to do it. Both of those, I would say, are questionable right now. Certainly on the ability side, we're dealing with political constituencies in both Israel and the Palestinian territories that don't have the greatest levels of support. Even with unity government, Olmert's ratings aren't what you would hope for. And so our desire to see this, the obviousness of it all, may be irrelevant if it is not doable for other realistic reasons. And then we'll call on others for questions, please. Just raise your hand and identify yourself.
Thanks, Matt. Let me take on your first question and just briefly. I think what we have in Pakistan is in these remote areas along the Afghanistan border is basically a sanctuary these days. I think that's the reality of it. And I think in some ways it resembles the sanctuary that Al-Qaeda had in Afghanistan. It's also different in many ways. In Afghanistan, the Al-Qaeda elements there had the direct support of the Taliban government. So there are differences. But I think we're sticking our heads in the sand if we say that, if we don't understand that there is a sanctuary in these remote parts of Pakistan. And it has reached out and hurt the rest even recently. I mentioned Germany, and we can look at, there's direct connections. The terrorists behind some of the plots in London and the attacks in London over the last couple of years trace back to training camps in Pakistan. So that's the first point. The second point is concerning bin Laden. I think it's extraordinarily important to either kill or bring bin Laden to justice. I think that's extraordinarily important. I don't necessarily think that he's the person giving the orders today. Probably not. I think he's trying to sort of reassert his leadership. But this is, after all, one of the greatest conducted this great crime that caused 3,000 deaths suddenly in the United States and untold hundreds of billions of dollars in destruction and all the changes it's wrought in our society in the West. He has to be brought to judgment. Do I think that that is going to end this threat? No, not at all. Not at all. But we have to deal with him. The threat will continue, and I just think that ideology is out there. We have to deal with the root causes of it and find out, you know, how to turn this tide of radicalization. So I don't pretend to stand here and say that capturing bin Laden will diminish that overall threat. But I think as a separate issue, it is still extraordinarily important to make him pay for what he has done.
Okay, in answer to Matt's question here about the peace process, every government in the Middle East can read the United States like an open book. They know when we're going through the motions. They know when we're profoundly serious about something. We make it clear, they read it loud and clear. And so what's important here is that every government knows that this is something we deeply, fundamentally care about, and it is at the top of the list of our priorities. Matt's right. I mean, he can start a list. Everyone in this room can add to it. Then I'll add some, too, as to why it's hard for the Olmert government and hard for the Palestinians and hard for everybody to make progress. And, you know, the first, second, third time you try may not get you there. It's probably going to take years. But President Clinton said something once which is worth repeating here. He said, at least we got caught trying to make peace. We didn't succeed. But the impression you create and leave and the confidence you build, the influence you gain, is well worth the effort. And I think it's a profound mistake to not make that investment.
Excellent. Thank you very much. If you could just raise your hands and identify yourselves when you're called, and that'd be great. Rob Sala?
Hi. Rob Sala. I'd like to frame my question by putting the article by the governor and the congressman, counterposing that against a very interesting article that was in the New York Times yesterday, where Jane Perlez interviewed all these Europeans, especially Germans and French and I think Swiss, she asked them, why do you think you guys are being the target of terrorism when you don't have the baggage the United States had? And there was a long article inside the paper, and the basic conclusion was that the Europeans came to was, you know, we didn't do Iraq, we support Palestinians, it can't really be about policy. It has to be something deeper, more about, you know, there are jihadists who just don't like the West or are targeting weak links or something, but it's not so much about policy. My question is not to ask you to is it policy or isn't policy. It's to use the phrase, what metrics do we really have to go to the basic questions of recruitment? You know, to what extent will recruitment be affected by A, B, C, or D on one scale? And the other side is the object of the policy change objective, is it to decrease recruitment or is it to increase other states' support for our counterterrorism efforts, which are two very different objectives, it seems to me. One might be achieved by certain policy changes. Another might not be achieved by any policy changes at all. So I want to ask you, Chris, to be a little bit more specific on what really is the target here. Is the target decreasing recruitment? Is the target long-term sympathy with the United States? Is the target getting states to, foreign governments to support our other policies more generally? And how do we measure what the connection is between changes in policies and what it is that we're trying to achieve?
Thanks for the question. I'll start. Mike may want to add. You can get into a long debate about metrics, and personally, I don't think that's altogether too helpful. I think the most important metric is to measure where we are today based on the very best judgment we have from the National Intelligence Estimate, which is what we're doing now isn't working all that well. Not in terms of our defenses, where our defenses are better, and we've probably also been lucky, but in terms of the threat outside our borders, not the threat we've been able to stop at our borders. I think what's important about the things I've suggested really would be all of the above. you surely do increase the ability of key states to work with us when there's a greater level of comfort with our policies and the nature of our relationship, of our bilateral relationship with those governments. Recruitment, it's difficult to measure, we don't have very good intelligence to establish a baseline against which to measure about how many Al-Qaeda members are there and how many were there 2 years before that. And I'm not sure how productive it is, but one thing that we do know is true is that terrorists have to operate in a milieu, in a society, in a place, in a culture. And the more that both governments can control territory and win the support of their own populations against these people, the more successful we will be. I can't give you a political science formula here for how to measure that. I do know that present policy isn't working. And the governor and Mr. Hamilton certainly think that the course they have recommended really has not been pursued very effectively. And they do think it offers a far better opportunity for making headway on the underlying threat.
Barbara, over here.
Let me say a quick word to that. And I don't really have much to add to what Chris said, but if you do a thought experiment and sort of, let's say you removed the policy irritants, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict was resolved to everyone's satisfaction and so on, that wouldn't remove the fault lines that exist in Europe with their problem with Muslims, the sort of sense of despair and the poverty and marginalization that exists there. So I think that would still exist. So, I think clearly progress on both fronts is warranted. But I think those problems would still persevere.
Hi, Barbara Slavin from USA Today. I wanted to ask about the influence of Iraq. It seems as though we're damned if we do and damned if we don't. If we stay, this is a huge bonanza for the recruiting of jihadis. And if we leave and the country becomes even more chaotic and violent, that also seems to be a huge bonanza. How is there any particular way in which you would try to handle Iraq to minimize the damage that's already been done to the U.S. reputation? Thanks.
Well, Mr. Hamilton and the governor didn't say too much about Iraq yesterday, in part because they wanted to stay focused on the commission's recommendations. I think the way they noted it is the way I should hear, that it has contributed to the threat we face, both in terms of recruiting and training. There's little doubt about that. And without being drawn further into policy prescriptions, we simply have to find a responsible exit from that country soon. And, you know, Mr. Hamilton's views are well detailed in the Iraq Study Group report, if you want to refer to that.
Ali Liami from the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia. I am actually surprised here today. There has been no mention about the root causes of terrorism and extremism, and how do you expect to defeat either of those or both if the institutions that feeds into them, especially the Saudi institutions and money, haven't even been mentioned here today? So how do you propose to deal with a problem that is being fed with money and religious ideology? And Mr. Levitt, you are also invited to answer this question because you are, you know.
Well, I curtailed this a little bit in my opening remarks, fully expecting that the question would come up.
Now it's here.
The 9/11 Commission talked about the importance of supporting reform in Saudi Arabia and building a better relationship between our societies and not simply between our two governments based on trading oil for security. The administration began a strategic reform dialogue with Saudi Arabia. It met once in November of 2005. It met again in May of 2006. It has not resumed since then. I believe they're trying to schedule a ministerial-level meeting on the strategic dialogue again in the fall. I'm personally not aware that that's been set. That dialogue encompasses many things. One of the six topics is reform. I don't think, as I stand here, that we can say it's been a very productive dialogue. The fact of the matter is that most of what we and Saudi authorities talk about are the I countries, probably Iraq and Iran in order, and also Israel in the peace process. And the questions of pragmatic reform don't really come up. That said, there are small stirrings of change in the kingdom. One can point to positive steps here and there, and one can equally point to steps to the side and steps backward. Reform in Saudi Arabia is surely not linear. The question is, what can the United States do to be supportive of that? Probably not making speeches and banging Saudi leaders over the head. But diplomats are very capable people, and with proper guidance and encouragement from the top, I think we could be making more headway in support of reform in Saudi Arabia, which would be slow. It's Saudi Arabia. It's going to be slow. But more can be done, and surely in the view of the Commission, should be done.
Chris Hamilton, formerly the Institute and formerly the FBI. You've done a wonderful job explaining the problem, and that's good, bringing us up to date on that. My question focuses on what to do about that, because clearly we haven't really decided where we're going to go. I've just finished reading the new Army Counterintelligence Manual, on our Counterinsurgency Manual, which is a really wonderful document, and it was overseen by General Petraeus. And if anybody gets it, this document gets it. And there are two things in there that I think are very important in what we're talking about here. And some of them were addressed actually in the 9/11 Commission report. The one is unity of effort, and the second is the paradoxes. In other words, in order to be successful in the counterinsurgency that we're facing, we have to do things almost the opposite of what we were doing before. We have to use less force. We have to raise our risk, things like that. And the other day, there was actually a good show on CNN which really addressed this issue in Afghanistan. It pertained to the drugs in the poppy fields. I don't know if anybody saw that. It was really a heart-wrenching story. But there's a massive effort of the DEA in Afghanistan to destroy these poppy fields. And they were going through the poppy fields, and the farmers were begging them, please do not destroy this because my life depends on it. They don't use the drugs. And even if the drugs did not get to Europe or wherever in the United States, they were successful because by destroying those poppy fields, they were getting recruits. So it's clear in this situation that the drug war is more important than the terrorism war. We made a choice. This is the part of the paradox I'm talking about. We made a choice. Drugs are more important there than the terrorism war, because this is not helping our hearts and minds issue. And there's other examples, too. There's DHS. The question is this. In order to attain that unity of effort, implicit in the 9/11 Commission report, nobody's ready to change things now, but what would you do If you had the choice, say after another catastrophic attack, what would you do to change the organization and attain unity of effort in this counterinsurgency? Hard question, huh?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand the question. That what would we recommend in the aftermath of another
catastrophic attack? In other words, we have DHS, we have DEA. Well, forget the catastrophic attack. We do not have unity of effort, or do you think we do have unity of effort? In other words, we would need one commander in charge with one chain of command and so on and so forth. Would you, for example, change the status of CIA, FBI, and all these intelligence organizations? How would you integrate the military into something like this? Okay, it's a hard question.
Well, I guess in partial and probably unsatisfactory response to your question, the Commission's recommendations on unity of effort in the intelligence community structurally were addressed. Now, that said, implementation is long, slow, difficult, frustrating, convoluted, and we're getting there. Now, the bigger question you raise is about unity of effort across the United States government, and that's really beyond what we're prepared to speak to today, but I just simply offer that the National Security Council process just doesn't work very well. It just gets overwhelmed and overloaded, and it's very hard to get focus and attention on more than one or two issues at a time. And right now, the number one issue is Iraq, and number two is whatever else is important, and everything else just falls off the table. That's a personal view, but that's sort of the way it looks.
I'm seeing everybody and answering the order that I see them, so we'll get to everybody. Michael Kraft.
Yeah, hi. Mike Kraft, former State Department Counterterrorism Office and now a consultant and writer. I have one very specific question for Mike and a broader one for both of you. Mike, you said that in your opening remarks in Pakistan that militants have been transiting airports without interference. As you may know, the U.S. government's put in a fairly extensive terrorist interdiction program at the airports to try to filter these people out. And do you know if this is being bypassed willfully or people turning a blind eye? A more general question is, you both talked about certain program issues where funding has been cut, and Mike kind of suggested aircraft carriers instead of aid. For example, Afghanistan reconstruction. Chris talked about education programs. The 9/11 Commission described an FBI official nearly falling off the floor, falling off his chair when you got budget cuts after 9/11. The State Department anti-terrorism programs have been cut back. At OMB and the congressional appropriations level. In fact, it seems to me a picture of a lot of nuts and bolts programs, not terribly glamorous, but have been underfunded. And granted, throwing dollars at everything is not going to necessarily solve it, but it can fill some of the gaps. I was wondering if you have any insight from both your congressional and executive branch experience as to the mentality or what, if anything, can be done to put more focus on the priority. Is it, as Chris suggested, that NSC doesn't really focus on these things or sees an OMB problem, and also the House Appropriators in particular, as Chris knows, have been, you know, cutting back some of these programs, and maybe it's an impossible process, but just wondering if you have any insights on what can be done to or what steps can maybe be done to try to affect the metal and budget outlooks.
Just a quick word on your first question. That my sourcing really for that it came from reporting, but from several reporting sources. It doesn't come from government reporting, but it comes from journalists on the ground. I've seen several articles by reputable reporters who have talked about the sort of known Taliban sort of transiting airports in Pakistan, et cetera. And a kind of a broader problem too. Then this is we've been aware of this for a number of years, but just the physical, visible presence of Taliban leaders in some of the towns in these remote regions of Pakistan. So it's very much an ongoing problem.
Mike, thanks for the question. Budget is always a key part of it. You can't have foreign policy without the dollars to go with it, of course. It's really with OMB and the president's choices of priorities. OMB is so critical in establishing those priorities. And Mike and I have both spent time on the Hill and see all the things that go on, all the games and that go back and forth. But at the end of the day, 95% of the president's request gets funded. The fighting is about certain pet programs that members want or that they don't want, and you know, all the hue and cry is over them. Now, if the president put forward a really healthy increase in the 150, the foreign affairs account, and stood by it, made it a priority at the top of his list, he'd get it. Or she'd get it. Or most of it, at any rate. And I didn't want to come back to Iraq, but I have to for a minute. We're spending between $2 and $3 billion a week. What program of the United States government wouldn't want to get a week's worth or even a day's worth of the money that we're spending there? And there's so much that we could be doing.
Thank you, Matt.
Alfred Moses, Monetary Financial Group, former ambassador, special envoy, presidential counsel. Chris, I was intrigued by your emphasis on foreign exchange students. Sounds wonderful, and all of us would vote in favor of it were we members of the Congress or otherwise. But I really question whether we have any metrics that determine whether that has been successful. Remembering that Amory Yamamoto was an exchange student before he bombed Pearl Harbor, Bulent Ecevit was an exchange student before he intervened in Cyprus.
And Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was a student here in the United States. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of students who come here. I can point to any bastard, and so can you. But if you look at the leaders in governments all over the world and the people who work with us, understand us, and help us to achieve our objectives, a lot of them have spent time in the United States.
Some have, but I know the emotional response and how strongly you feel about it. But I also remember when Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin were on the lawn of the White House, we had thousands of Iranian students shouting down with the Shah, and they went back and the Shah fell.
If you look at public opinion polls, where in the Middle East is the United States most popular right now? It's in Iran.
That's what we say.
Young Iranians who really hate their government, and whatever their government says about the United States, they don't believe, and they're intrigued by this country.
I think we're buying superficially here to some extent. I don't think we have any data, and there's an awful lot of, you call it perhaps idiosyncratic behavior.
Have you read the Fulbright reports? Read them forwards and backwards, and I rest my case.
I ran a Fulbright report. There's a vested interest in running that program, but I haven't seen the results come out of it, and I ran Fulbright programs. So I'm not condemning foreign
exchange. Right. Let's shut our doors. Let's go home.
Mm-hmm. No, come on, Chris. You have to be more rational than that. If that's the only kind of response you can make,
I'm being as rational as I can be.
Well, then there's not
because
an argument
to be made. Because this is protectionism. Taken to the nth degree.
They're shibboleths. That's not dealing with the subject.
I'm going to be trite, but forgive me. Look, this is a global economy. I personally believe that you should not be able to get a bachelor's degree at American University unless you have an international experience. Why? Because in the lifetime of that young person, everything that's going on outside of the United States is equally important as to anything that's going on inside the United States. And we're blind and foolish if we adopt the point of view that you seem to be propagating here.
Well, what I'm seeing you're propagating is you can't deal with al-Qaeda for exchange students. That's my point. And if you have data to the contrary, let's hear it.
What the 9/11 Commission spoke to was using all the tools of national policy. That includes military, intelligence, FBI. But there are many things that have been amply neglected by our leaders. and public diplomacy is a tool of it. So is diplomacy in general. I think your point is a fair one in the sense that I don't mean to give undue weight to public diplomacy above any other priority of the United States government. I'm simply noting that over time it has not had the emphasis that it deserves as a tool of counterterrorism policy.
I favor with you on in terms of public diplomacy. Students, I think there's a question mark.
All right. Simon.
I want to come back to the subject of Saudi Arabia. Yesterday, on ABC News last night, Stuart Levy, Treasury Undersecretary,
never heard of him.
Was interviewed briefly about terrorism financing and Al-Qaeda financing. And he came out with a pithy quote, which I'll use now and I'll be using extensively in the future. I could somehow snap my fingers and cut off the funding from one country, it would be Saudi Arabia. It raises the question, once again, is the kingdom on our side in the war on terrorism, or whatever you'd like to call it, or is it against us? And rather than a yes or no reply, is the situation getting better from our point of view, or is there no improvement at all? The fact that Undersecretary Levy should say this on the 6th anniversary of 9/11, I thought was extraordinary. That's
Someone get the man another sandwich. He's earning it.
You've got two gentlemen here, Matt Levitt and Mike Jacobson, who frankly are better qualified than I am or than Mike is to answer your question. So talk to them afterward.
I will just say this. Is this on? I will just say this. First of all, you're right in pointing out, I don't think it is a are you with us or against us question. It's much more nuanced than that. There's some things the Saudis do very, very well. They've taken more losses in combating threats within the kingdom than arguably anybody else. Also, his quote doesn't make as clear a statement about how good the Saudis are at combating terror financing. It's more of a statement that perhaps despite their efforts, perhaps their efforts aren't significant enough. What he's saying is that there still is a significant amount of money coming from within the kingdom. And that's a different statement. I personally think that it is absolutely still the case that while the Saudis are getting much better on some issues, when it comes to terror financing, this is perhaps the most critical area where there's a lot more that they could do. And I would argue, to follow up on the earlier question about reform, that it's something that they should be able to do quietly without much domestic repercussion, which means that there's less excuse for not doing it. But I also agree, knowing the individual in question who made the statement, that if he made the statement, since he made the statement and when he made the statement, was probably not by accident. Yes.
Stanley Kober with the Cato Institute. How would you assess the balance of power now in the Middle East?
In a word or two.
I'm sorry, that's beyond the purview of our remarks for today.
Yes.
P.J. Crowley from the Center for American Progress. Bringing a question back domestic and to the intelligence area, where the committee also spent a great deal of time and effort. Two-part question. You know, since we have adopted many of the commission's recommendations in terms of the NCTC and the DNI, how do you assess what the remaining intelligence role for the Department of Homeland Security is, since the formation of the department was in some form premised upon an analytical responsibility that's been largely superseded by the NCTC? And then secondly, how do you assess the relative progress of counterterrorism within the FBI and to the question of whether there's been sufficient progress within the FBI that makes an MI5 within the United States more or less likely.
You started out with easy questions, but you didn't end that way. Let's start with the FBI. It is still struggling to put together an analytic capability. It's still struggling to devise curricula for new analysts. It is struggling to define what role analysts play in their work with special agents. It is still struggling to break out beyond case-related analysis, tactical analysis. I don't think you can say with confidence that the FBI is able to do strategic analysis of the domestic threat. The role of DHS is important. You've got a gentleman heading it, Charlie Allen, who is an all-time bulldog and go-getter. If anyone's going to make that capability work, Charlie is formidable in making it happen. It's also important that DHS develop that capability because the FBI, at least from my point of view, isn't there yet. And you can't allow the strategic analysis of the domestic threat to be done through the back door by the CIA and the National Intelligence Council. It's got to be done by people who look at the domestic situation. So FBI has to step up to the plate, and so does DHS. And it just from the commissioner's point of view, however many problems there are with the FBI, however slowly it is moving, if you seek to create an MI5, then you're looking at another new 10 to 20 year project.
Mike.
Hi, Mike Jacobson, the Washington Institute. Was curious to hear your thoughts on, obviously I understand why there was a focus on the areas where things still need to improve and things aren't going so well. But are there areas that stand out from your perspective where things actually have gone surprisingly well, real actual success stories in terms of what the government has done? And I know that terrorist financing, as mentioned, was one area that was pointed out, so I wasn't trying to get a compliment for our own work. But are there other areas, even really aside from that, that stand out?
But if you wanted to mention that A-minus again, you could.
I was going to say terrorism financing. Well, I think, you know, you see examples of successes, periodically, and I think the case in point now is this plot in Germany that was thwarted. It looks like there were some problems sort of at the end that spurred the Germans to make the arrest sooner than they had originally wanted to, but it looks like there was some very good international intelligence and information sharing taking place among a variety of intelligence services and law enforcement services. And I think that's, you know, a positive thing, and we have to kind of give credit to that. Similarly, with this plot of last summer for the hijacking in London, the plot to hijack transatlantic flights, there was some excellent cooperation that went on there. So I think in terms of, and one of the big points, one of the big weaknesses before 9/11 was the whole question of information sharing among our own agencies, lots of deficiencies and gaps. I don't think that has all been remedied yet, nearly so, but I do think that we've made some kind of positive steps in that direction. I think NCTC, although it still has many, many faults and deficiencies, has made the system function a bit better in terms of information sharing on the counterterrorist threat among agencies. And so I think that's a fairly positive development.
Well, then with that, let me thank you both very, very much for taking the time to come and speak with us. Let me thank everyone who took the time to come and attend. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.